You're listening to the Big Three of B2B Leadership Podcast with Mike Faherty, where world-class business leaders share their secrets for personal, organizational, and market growth. Gain powerful insights from industry leaders that have been tested by the fire.
Well, welcome everyone back to the Big Three of B2B Leadership. I'm your host, Mike Faherty, and today I've got the pleasure of being joined by Andy Harris. Andy is a seasoned CEO and board member that leads private equity-backed Invest and Grow Ventures from 2012 to 2017. Most recently, Andy was the CEO of Accela Performance Materials, where he led the business to an explosive 6x revenue growth through both organic strategies as well as through an impressive 14 acquisitions. He has a degree in chemical engineering from the University of Arizona, an MBA from USC, and I am one particularly excited to have this conversation today. So thanks so much for joining me today, Andy.
I'm really happy to be with you, Mike, and really admire what you're doing, and it's an honor to be part of it.
Awesome, awesome. Well, thank you very much. Well, look, I wanted to kind of jump way back in the time machine, kind of go back to the beginning of your career. I always think it's interesting to kind of figure out where I see these moments seem to happen. And obviously, I mentioned you went to the University of Arizona, my alma mater. That's how we our paths crossed. And you went there as a chemical engineering student and graduated with a chemical engineering degree. But it wasn't long. It was only a few years before you got into the sales side of the house. And so I'm just kind of curious about that transition. Kind of what led to that? Was that something you were looking for? Or was it sort of a happy accident? Or tell me about that.
I guess it kind of a happy accident. It surely wasn't planned. Going into chemical engineering, I just went into chemical engineering actually for kind of the wrong reasons. It was the highest paying 4-year degree, right? And I was good in chemistry and math, so that's what I'm signing up for. And I did it, and I did really well in it. And then I came out, graduated from Arizona, and went to work for Exxon. And at that time, Exxon was the Fortune number one company in the world. So it was like the holy grail of being a chemical engineer working for the number one company in the world, and was off for a technical engineering career. But I learned pretty quickly that I didn't want to be on the technical track. It really wasn't the fit for me. And you know, hindsight now looking back, I made what's turned out to be really good. But at that time, I made the decision for the wrong reason, and that was I was chasing the salary that a chemical engineer would get as the highest paid salary for an undergraduate degree. Wrong reason, without a doubt, and I learned that. But I was responsible for some facilities in Exxon, the engineering in them, and part of that was I was responsible for the chemical programs, and chemicals are used to help the facilities run. And we were buying those chemicals from two kind of major chemical suppliers for production and process chemicals. And they both started trying to recruit me, said, "Hey, Andy, you'd make a great technical salesperson." And one of them won out, and they moved me from, I was living in New Orleans at the time, to Redondo Beach, California. And I was able to call on all the heavy industry in the Los Angeles basin, mainly a lot of refineries and oil refineries. It's kind of like, wow, it really turned out great. I went from being an engineer in New Orleans to now being technical salesperson, getting exceptional training, living in Redondo Beach, which was like kind of a dream come true as well for me at that time in my life. And just really loved it and learned all about, and the company I went with was exceptional training, learned all about value-added selling, solution selling, consultative selling. And we committed to returning all of our customers a dollar for every dollar they spent with us, right? In terms of improved efficiencies, improved, reduced water usage, reduced energy usage, whatever. But we would have to go in and learn their business, learn their process to understand how we were saving them money. And I learned a lot about that. And so that was really, you know, where I learned a lot about selling and grew up into some management in the company then over 10 years, went back to corporate in Pennsylvania, and really had a great initial start to my career in that And then that led me to general management and ultimately executive management. But as a leader, ultimately that, you know, as that I became, just, you know, I bleed more of a commercial. I'm more of a commercially oriented leader versus an operational or a financial. I'd say more commercial with sales and marketing in my blood.
Yeah, that's cool. So what was the biggest challenge in that transition from kind of the technical to the technical selling? I mean, what was it like kind of going through that transition?
Well, I think learning the selling process, right?
Right.
Because it is a process. And there are some people that are probably born natural salespeople, and that I don't believe that was me. So I had to learn that process, right? And learning how you ask the questions, what questions you ask, and then also really starting to think about you're solving a problem, right? And if you go about it as a consultant and solving a problem for the customer, you're the solution for the customer. Sometimes the customer doesn't know what the problems are, and you have to help them identify that in a right way. But it was probably just the sales process was what was at that point in time was the biggest challenge for me. The engineering side of it, the technical side of it, I got, and that was, you know, that was, so it was easy to start to solve the problems. It was the selling process.
Right. I think a lot of people who make that transition, I've seen it a lot. I've been in, you know, worked in the high tech industry most of my career and still service a lot of technical companies. That's really our focus. And so I've been around a lot of technical sales guys over the years. Never was one. I was always the pure sales guy. I always needed that other guy with me. I needed a guy like you to keep me out of trouble. But that, you know, the ones that really make that transition really well, the ones that that aren't the natural salespeople. I think there's a complete misunderstanding about what makes someone an effective salesperson. And one of those things is they have to be an outgoing, sort of vibrant person. That's not necessarily the case. What they have to have a commitment. They have to be able to build rapport. Sure. That's absolutely essential. People like to do business with people, and if they can't relate to you and they can't connect with you, it's not going to work. Right. But they also just need problem solved. And if you can really figure out what the problem is and you've got the ability to sort out what the problem is and figure out how to solve it for them, they really don't care what your golf score is. That really isn't what it's about. And so I imagine having the ability to kind of build rapport and having a personable personality in conjunction with the technical chops to really lead the conversation and lead the customer to a solution has obviously been a big part of your success up to this point. So that's pretty fascinating.
Yes.
So what, were you worried about losing your engineering cred?
No, that was never, it's always been a foundation for me. Right.
Yeah.
And then, so you have the engineering and then you get the MBA, and it's a pretty cool combination. So it worked well together.
That's good. I've talked to technical people say, look, I don't want to go that route because I don't want to get too far away from the technical side. I don't want to lose touch with that. And others that can't wait to, you know, they're like, I got that. I understand it well enough. Now I want to do this other thing. So it's funny. I've had those conversations with young people as they're sort of struggling with when they were presented with those opportunities, you know, hey, we think you, just like was presented to you, right? We think you could really be successful over here in this other capacity using what you know. Sometimes that's a struggle for them. Like, well, I've just spent all this time learning this technical knowledge. Now, you know, I thought I was going to be an engineer. I thought that was the idea, right?
Well, and some of the best salespeople that I've ever known or either developed or learned from, you know, they came from a very technical, they came out of the lab or out of the R&D department or out of just technical support or engineering, and then they evolved and grew and learned how to be, you know, great salespeople. And it really gets back to what you said earlier. It's just solving problems, right?
Sure.
And if you can communicate pretty well,
right.
And I actually had some salespeople. I know some salespeople that were so good at what they did technically with solving problems, but they were all actually a little bit abrasive, and customers would get, you know, almost throw them out. Right.
Right.
But the next day they'd say, I need them back because that's my problem. Right. So,
right.
You know, if you're good at solving problems, You can take you a long way.
It can. Obviously this podcast is really about growth in a lot of different ways, personally, organizationally, as well as business-wise or commercially. And so one of the things that I was just really excited about talking with you about today is just your really extensive background in M&A. So I want to kind of talk about mergers and acquisitions as a growth strategy. So I thought maybe you could start with kind of the first acquisition or merger that you were a part of, and kind of how did that come about? Where was that? And kind of what was your first introduction to this process?
Well, I think, first of all, acquisition can be a really key part of someone's strategy, whether you're an entrepreneur or whether you're a large publicly held strategic company, if you will. It's a way to add technology. It's a way to add market share. It's a way to expand into a different region. Maybe you're a West Coast-based company that's really great at what you do, but you could buy someone that's doing something very similar on the East Coast, and now all of a sudden you're nationwide. And it could be, there's lots of reasons that acquisitions make sense from a strategic perspective. So I have been a hired gun CEO. So I would be hired as a CEO by a private equity firm who has either an idea, a concept, or maybe they already have the company that they want to grow, and largely wanted to grow organically, right? Going out and selling and solving problems, but then also acquisitively doing acquisitions. And many times it's called a roll up in that case. And you're rolling up a business that's all doing the same thing. Maybe it's, and in my case, it was nationwide and then also into Europe. And I've done it a couple times. And we can create a lot of value for the owner of that business or the investors of the business, and also value for the customers. Because you can expand capabilities, you can expand service, you can expand product offering. And maybe as you get larger, you're able to buy better. So your supply chain is more efficient and you get better pricing, and then you can pass that on to your customers. So in my experience, a lot of this turned into also be valuable. We were able to add more value to customers. So I think acquisitions are a really key part of the growth strategy. And my first business that I was a hired gun in started in 2006. It was a company called Surgis, and it was very specialized chemicals. We had an oil and gas chemical business. We had a personal care sunscreen, the main ingredient in sunscreens. We made that product. And then we had a plastics additives business that went into anything that's fiberglass plastic. So very three very different businesses, but we managed them, standardized them, pulled them all together, and basically professionalized them. We standardized the selling process across the board because they were all B2B, very high value, technically oriented selling. While different markets, the process was the same, and we standardized that as an example. And as we got bigger, then we were attractive to strategics that needed the chemistries and the capabilities we had that were complementary to them. And we sold to a strategic then. So we built that business over 5 years, and then actually ended up unwinding it. So it wasn't just one sale, it was three sales. We sold the oil and gas business to an oil and gas, large oil and gas equipment company. We sold the plastics additives business to another competitor that was probably number two or number three in the world. We were number one and number two in Europe and the US. And so that when they bought us, they immediately became number one. And then we sold the sunscreen business to a small group of investors that really just wanted that niche business.
That's interesting. So I think a lot of business leaders are intimidated by the M&A process. I mean, it seems like maybe something that's unattainable or too complicated to really pursue. Why do you think there's so much apprehension in pursuing that strategy?
Well, I think acquisitions are not easy, right? I guess there's some risk. You have to spend a lot of money to do an acquisition. You know, to get through the due diligence and the legal and the tax and insurance and sales and all, you know, you can spend hundreds of thousands to $1 million to get through a deal. And then let's say the deal doesn't close, you've spent that money, you're not going to recover it, right? So I think there's potentially some risk with that. But if you have a really well-defined strategy about what you want and what you're going to go after, then when you do get the deals, it all pays off. So I think that's part of it. The other part of it is to get a deal to happen, you know, you've got to look at a lot of, you may say, here's the company I want to buy, but maybe they don't want to sell. Or maybe once you start looking at them, you find out, wow, they're not, there's a lot of issues with the company. So it's, you know, I think for probably every 10 companies we looked at, it ultimately only ended up with one that we are. So it takes a lot of time to look at all these different companies to get the one that you're going to acquire. And at the next company I was with, which was Accela, and you mentioned that at the beginning of the call, we did 14 acquisitions in 4 years. So we were doing 2 to 3 acquisitions a year. And so, you know, we're looking at 10 or 15 or 20 to get to those 2 to 3. And we, our goal was to, we were very singular in what we did. But it was a really fragmented business. So there was a lot of smaller businesses like that around the United States. And our goal was to become the acquirer of choice. If an entrepreneurial or a family held business was thinking about selling in this space, they thought, wow, Accela is the company I want to sell to because good culture, good team, good leadership. I know they'll treat our people well. And I'm handing, you know, my baby and my legacy over to some, putting into somebody else's good hands, right? And they trusted that. And it takes a long time to build that trust.
Right. So when, you know, when a deal doesn't go right, let's talk about that for a second. You know, you've done so many acquisitions. I don't know if any of them, they've all been home runs, but maybe there's been one or two dogs in there somewhere. When something doesn't go, when the acquisition doesn't go as planned, when you do the postmortem on that, what do you find to be the biggest, you know, the mistake that is most commonly made, or the step that maybe you didn't spend as much time on that caused that deal to not be as attractive as you had hoped it would be?
I think it may get down to it just really evaluating the technology, right? Do they have the technology that they said they had? Does it work the way if they really thought it would? That would be one of the ones. And another one is culture. And to me, culture trumps strategy. And so you, if you have okay strategy and exceptional culture, you can win. If you've got the best strategy and not good culture, you very likely might not win. So it's assessing the culture of that company and then how well you can integrate that culture into your culture. And then as the cultures come together, that culture continues to evolve and hopefully further improve. Okay. So culture is a big issue that I think companies come together and their cultures clash and it just doesn't work. So that could be one of the reasons as well.
Can you have a good culture and a good culture and they come together to equal a bad culture? I mean, is it possible that they're all wonderful people who are all, you know, doing the right thing and have the, you know, have similar values, but something doesn't work when they come together?
I think that can happen especially if it's one feels like more dominant over the other, right? And you see this happen with mergers or even when you're doing a bunch of things. And so as the leadership team has to not allow that to happen. And you'll sometimes see mergers where there's two leaders that come together and they don't really announce one's the leader and one's not. Or let's say one is the prevalent leader and the other one exits the business, right? That prevalent leader can't act like we bought you, right? And that's when you can have that happen. And we're the one leading the show and controlling the show. It's not that. It needs to be we are, you know, collectively we're figuring this out. And And, you know, that was a little bit of my leadership style, and our leadership team style was really servant leadership. We're bringing these cultures together. We're here to serve you. All the companies we acquired had elements in their cultures that were good. And we wanted to carry those on and maybe even help the other companies that didn't have that pick that up. And then vice versa, bring it, you know, if there were bad elements, we didn't want to like shine big lights on and say, boy, you've got a horrible culture. But, you know, you would highlight your good elements and the positive areas of culture. And to me, the number one thing is trust. If the teams, and it takes a little bit of time, but when the teams, the employees start to trust each other and they trust leadership and leadership trusts the teams, then those two cultures, you won't have that clash and that conflict. But you also have to get rid of that one was better than the other. You just can't allow that kind of thinking that we're all together now and we're all equal. And we've got a new great culture that's taking the best of everything that we've pulled together.
Is it harder to do that with an acquisition where it was really clearly, you know, we're big, you're little, we bought you, we'll find a place for you. We've got a plan for you and we love you, but let's not confuse, you know, who's in charge here.
Well, surely. And at Excel, as we got larger, we started, the initial company we acquired was an $80 million revenue company. And we were, you know, north of $450 million in revenue. And so, you know, when we were in the 300 range, still growing, and you're acquiring a $40 million company, you know, it's obvious we're the larger company acquiring a small one. But we really tried to convey the message how much we needed that company and the fit that it needs strategically. Why was this company being acquired? It wasn't just simply we took to acquire another company. It was either they had a niche in a market. They had maybe some unique manufacturing, maybe geographically they were really desirable. We didn't have a manufacturing site where they were, and we needed one. Maybe they had great people, but you always, we just try to highlight the main reasons for why the business was a strong fit with us. And now they're part of something bigger and greater. And hopefully we were going to give them, and I think in largely most cases we did, their skies were brighter and bluer. They had more opportunities now being part of something larger and yet still keeping the small entrepreneurial family-like culture that they were in. We had that alive and well in a bigger entity.
Right. So obviously a big part of pulling off mergers and acquisitions and this type of strategy is leadership. And as I went into kind of researching and preparing for our chat today, I've found a lot of really, really positive feedback on you as a leader, which I would expect. But one thing that really stuck out to me is one person described you as a servant leader. And I'm just wondering if you could kind of expound on that. What does that mean to you, servant leadership? And would you categorize your leadership style as servant leadership?
Absolutely. I think it is what I lead with is servant style. So, I encouraged and basically the leadership teams that I served on and worked with, I think we all worked as servant. And so the servant leadership is that, you know, as the CEO, I'm here to serve the company. The company is not here to serve me, right? The company actually is to serve our customers and solve our customers' problems. We need to be really good at doing that. But in how we do that, it for me as the CEO or the leader and our leadership team, we have to make sure, you know, we're serving our employees to make sure they have, first of all, an appropriate workplace, a great workplace, a place they want to go to work, where they want to go to work every day, that they're proud of, and they're proud of the purpose of what the company's doing, and that why. So I kind of serve in terms of defining that why and helping people really understand that, and then, you know, serving the employees, giving them the tools they need, the training they need. And hopefully, you know, what they say is kind of like train people and then just get out of their way, let them go do it. And so that gets back to the trust, really trusting people that they're going to do their job and that really well. If you give them what they need, they will do their job really well, trusting that and empowering that. I'm a big believer that everybody gets out of bed in the morning and thinks, I'm gonna be great today, right? I'm gonna be great at my job. I'm gonna be a great husband or a great wife, whatever. People don't get out of their bed thinking, boy, I'm gonna suck today, right? People aren't wired that way. I trust that, and if you empower that, and if you're as a servant leader, you're trying to help that, and so I'm here to help people be great every day. That's the reason I'm here. I'm not here to pound on the desk and say, what have you done for me lately? And, you know, be a bit very dictatorial type command and control leader. That's not me. And in my opinion, that's not as effective as, it can't be in the short run, but in the long run, it's not as effective as a servant leadership style. Yeah. And I think the other key part of servant leadership is that there's no one employee that's any more important or any less important in an organization. Everybody has to do their job well every day. And especially in some of the smaller organizations, if any one of the people don't do their job well, you feel it. Especially as a CEO, if I don't do my job well, everyone's gonna feel it. And I just affected a lot of people's lives. And so I think there's a great deal of responsibility and the servant approach shows through that thinking.
I love that. I was reminded as you were talking of Built to Last. I don't know if you've read that book about the HP, Home Depot's sort of ascension into dominance in their particular segment. And I think Khan, the gentleman who wrote the book with his partner, they represent their org chart as an upside down triangle. And that was, I just love that visual of saying, look, I'm at the bottom and I'm serving, everyone is serving the level above them. And the top of this triangle is really all of our frontline employees are the people who are dealing with our customers who are customer facing or individual contributors, if you will. And so I love that visual of saying, you know, it's turning that traditional hierarchy of an organization, flipping it over and saying, look, we're all serving the people above us on this, in this diagram. So, I think that's really interesting. And, you are in a world where you're acquiring so many companies, and you're going through this process over and over again. I've always been fascinated by this idea. And so maybe you could walk me through it because I'm really interested. You've got an executive leadership team, right? You've got a cabinet, if you will, of your chief leaders, the people that you go to and that you trust, who are highly capable, and you've built this team. And maybe they've come up in the organization or however they got there, they're there. Mm-hmm. Then you acquire this company. And let's say you're a $350 million company, you acquire a $40 million company who has let's say they got a CEO or a CFO or someone on that team that's just an absolute rock star. They're just an absolute rock star. And now you're stuck in this sort of challenge, like that guy might be better than my guy, but mm-hmm. this guy is here. And that guy, I now have that guy as a resource that's available to me to put into this organization someplace. How do you reconcile that? And how do you approach that opportunity? I don't want to call it a challenge, but that opportunity of saying, look, I've got a real valuable asset right here. A great resource that can really contribute more to this organization at maybe some of the higher levels. You know, how do you kind of process that?
Yeah, it's a challenge because sometimes you'll make a move quick, right? If it's a true rock star and the person that on your team, this is the new person doing this role and this person's in a different role. Usually that's, it's, you know, most leaders have a hard time pushing those buttons so fast, right? And I think that's probably some of my style too, not real quick to make those decisions. But you have to bring this rock star in and you keep them on your team. Maybe you have them doing some other things. And over time, then in that case, you can evolve into maybe a different role for them. Or maybe it just becomes so kind of evident to the team and to the organization that transition that needs to be made will make. And then it's pretty evident to everybody. So giving that time for that to naturally occur can also be a way to do it. That's a big challenge. It's a good challenge to have, it's a challenge.
Yeah, it seems that's one of the beauties of that strategy is now you've got these people who are exceptional leaders and they're on your team. And so what a great opportunity to find really high quality people who can really contribute at a high level, who will come in and do exceptional work. You might be an embarrassment of riches at times that I've got, okay, well, maybe I have too many of these people and they could serve themselves better by being outside the organization and finding something that's a better fit for them right now. Just to have, being able to have the confidence to say, you know, your best opportunity is not within this organization right now.
And some people will self-select, right? They'll self-select out I haven't been in a case where, wow, we had so many A players around us, you had to basically start telling people, you know, you're better served somewhere else. We can always find good opportunities for good people. You just repurpose or maybe create a new position or find some other way that they'll add value, because a lot of people are not just singularly good at just one thing, right? If you're a good employee especially as you're at any level, I mean, you can learn new skills and add value in a lot of different ways.
Right. What's maybe your short list of qualities or attributes that you look for in a key executive? Someone is going to be on your team that you want to really put your weight behind to support their growth and their development and their progress in the organization. Like, what are you looking for?
Well, I think the first thing is, I've used that word is again, right? Can you trust them? And also, are they trusting? That's important to me, that it's, that trust is a big two-way street. I think the other thing is just, it's attitude, right? An attitude to just do what it takes to get it done. A really willingness to do that and a willingness to learn. I think some type of self-awareness that, we're not all great at everything. And we definitely need really great people around us. Right. And it's good to be part of a great team and be able to rely on and work closely with the other team members. And hold yourself accountable for what your role is on the team, and in a collaborative, a positive way, hold the others on the team accountable too, right? And that's what to me makes a really a high functioning team. Getting back to your question about as an individual employee, whether it's a key executive or whatever level it is in the organization, I think everything that I just said applies, from the entry level position all the way up to the leadership team.
So we're talking about acquisitions. I know you're a part of an organization now, the selling to strategics. So I hope I have that right. So talk to me a little bit about that business and kind of how you're taking some of your experience as a leader in this space, finding strategic acquisitions and how you're sort of applying that to your new business.
Okay, great. Yeah, so the company I'm with now is called STS Capital, which is selling to strategics. And basically, you know, we help entrepreneurs or family held businesses, middle market businesses, I'd say revenues typically around 50 million and above, and transaction values that their business would sell from 50 million up to a billion or more. We advise them and consult with them, and then ultimately we'll take them to market to sell their business to a strategic. And it's a strategic is a company that's not a private equity, not a financial investor type group. You're selling it to another business, right? That is strategic, and your company makes a strategic fit for some of the reasons I mentioned earlier. Maybe it's geographically brings something, a new geography to the company. It brings new technology, needed manufacturing, whatever it is, but there's some real strong strategic fit why, you know, your business fits well with another business. And so we enable that process and help that owner achieve an extraordinary exit. But then also along the way, there's another really big list of things that owners want to, and it's not always, I want to get the highest price for my business. It may be, I want my employees really well taken care of. The dollar amount, right? They're going to get probably good value for their business if it's a good business anyways. But we'll help the business owners achieve those requirements they really want to see happen, and then also get them the highest value for their business. And we're good at doing that because we're all the leaders in STS Capital are people like myself. They're operators. They've been there and done that. We're not a traditional investment bank that, you know, I didn't learn mergers and acquisitions because I had jobs on Wall Street working in investment banks. I learned this, the M&A process by doing it. Mm-hmm. And I've done, you know, over 20 transactions in my career, totaling over $1 billion. And so especially when it relates back to entrepreneurial and family held businesses, I strongly relate to the process that they have to go through to sell their business. And I want to help advise them and coach them on that to sell to a strategic and really achieve their everything they want to achieve. If they could name their ideal outcome, we work hard to make that happen.
So it sounds like you're not just taking them to market, but there's also some work to help them get ready to go to market in the early stages. Is that right?
Exactly. Some investment banks just want to take you to market and they want to get it done in 6 months, right? And they've got a good process to make that happen. And that's fine. And we can do that as well. But typically some of the business have a little bit of things that need to be done and that will really increase the value of the business. So maybe it takes 6 months to get those things done. Maybe it takes a year. So we'll work with that company for a year before we even go to market, and we'll advise them and consult with them on that. And that also makes us unique, that we're not just here just to get a deal done. We know what creates strategic value. And so we can kind of do our initial due diligence on the company because we've all been there and done that. We're like, oh, well, if you could do this organizationally, you need to hire this person. Your financials, there's a few things we need to work on here and there. You know, maybe there's some things that need to be removed from the business to make it look more valuable or make it more valuable. Just things, there's a lot of different areas that we can create value in a relatively short period of time for the ultimate exit.
So in a perfect world, how much runway would you want? So if I have one of these businesses and, you know, I had a plan that, hey, in the next, I don't know, let's say 5 to 10 years, I'm going to sell this business. What point would you want to engage with me prior to that sort of that date where I'm ready to, I want to be done with it?
You know, I think like in my experience, there are some businesses that are high quality businesses that are ready to go to market, and they're not going to take a lot of work. And, you know, you can go to market in 6 to 9 months and you're finished. In others, it might take, okay, we're going to need to take a good 6 to 12 months or maybe even longer to really do some things. The business needs some work, and then we'll go to market. So I would say, you know, and ideally, you said in an ideal 1 to 2 years would be a reasonable amount of time to get that done. And really have a big impact on the ultimate outcome for the business owner in terms of achieving an extraordinary exit.
Well, that's awesome. Well, good luck with that. It sounds really cool. I love the idea of focusing on the strategic buyer. I think in most cases, that's what most of the types of businesses, the mid-market clients that you're talking to, that's ultimately, I think, what they want. I think they just feel more comfortable with that idea. Maybe I'm biased, but that's certainly what I would imagine would be most rewarding to me, is to be acquired by a strategic buyer.
Yeah, I mean, you hear the stories about Microsoft buying somebody, right? Microsoft is a strategic buyer. They've got a lot of acquisitions. So is Apple, so is Google, yeah, and Amazon, right? As examples. But there's also a big universe of private equity financial investors out there that they're really good at buying companies and building them. And that's what I did, putting them together. And then they make them even more attractive to a strategic buyer down the road. The problem is the initial owner doesn't really get all of that value, right? But private equity is easy to sell to. The process is a little quicker. Sometimes that's kind of compelling that, you know, I can sell my business to a private equity firm and get a reasonable value, not the highest price, but get reasonable value, and they can get it done quickly. So that there's something to be said for that too. Sure. But yeah, for those that have a little bit of more time and want to make sure they get their optimum outcomes and sell to a strategic, that's what STS does and is exceptional at helping do.
So, Andy, you and I crossed paths when I first came to know you, and we first met through the Wildcat Mentor Society. So, first of all, why don't you just talk a little bit about what that is, and then, you know, I'm curious, kind of, you're sort of been the champion for this program at the University of Arizona. So, why don't you talk a little bit about the Wildcat Mentor Society?
Sure. Yeah, I founded it. It was kind of my idea. I took it to the university. They liked it a lot. So, you know, we hear about mentoring, and I think most people understand the potential value of a mentor. For the first half of my career, I really didn't have mentoring. And it wasn't until the second half of my career, which all of a sudden light bulb went off about, wow, I need a mentor. And I actually had some mentors that helped me. And all of a sudden things, you know, my trajectory changed in so many different ways, not just career-wise, but personally as well. And so, The Wildcat Mentor Society is unique. There's not another public university or private university that we're aware of that has a program that's like this. And it's a cohort style mentoring program. So we'll take anywhere from 3 to 4 to 5 students and match them in a cohort, in a group, with one mentor. So that mentor is going to mentor the group, right? And they meet on a monthly basis in group, and it's a confidential group. So kind of what goes on in the cohort stays in the cohort. It's a trusted environment, and it's more life coaching. So it's not just career. It's not just, we're going to help you get a job when you get out. It's, we're going to help you get through school. You got so many, students have so many things they're contending with and challenges during just getting through to get to graduation. So the cohort's going to help. They're going to help each other do that under the leadership of a mentor. Maybe the mentor is going to be the only one giving advice. But what we found is each one of them has a challenge or an issue. And the other one's like, oh, I had that too. Or I have that right now. Or my brother had that, and here's how he did it. And they actually end up mentoring and counseling and helping each other as much or more than maybe the mentor would if he was just, or she were one-on-one with them. So it's a really powerful cohort style of a mentor program that meets once a month in group, in a safe group, if you will. And then the mentor is still available one-on-one to help the individuals with those challenges. If there's other areas that need more time spent, or you know, somebody wants to just have a one-on-one session, maybe they don't want to bring it up in the cohort, the mentor does that as well. But and then these cohorts can live on. So once you're in your the cohort I have, it's the same. We have the same people we've had for 3 years now. So they really know each other well now. They trust each other. And they're there to really help each other a lot and challenge each other and hold each other accountable. And it's just a really, I think it's a really cool program. There's no other program that we're aware of. And we've talked to a lot of other universities about their mentor programs that's like this. And it's really powerful. It's almost doubling every year in size, and we make a big difference in a lot of people's lives with really a relatively small amount of investment of time, from the mentor's perspective and also from the mentee's perspective.
It's fascinating. I absolutely love being a part of the program. I'm with my second cohort this year, and last year was an interesting group because I had some people that were recent graduates. They weren't even at the university anymore. They had graduated the year before. Last year was a tough year, right? These kids, I should say kids, these sort of young people had, they kind of had a lot of the reward that they were looking forward to kind of stolen from them, through COVID and no graduation and some of the things that they were looking forward to their last semester of school just sort of dashed and, jobs. You know, I had people who had accepted jobs and were, you know, were ready to move to New York City where they were ready to start this new job, and the job offer got rescinded, you know, and some struggles, right? They just kind of went through some things, and it was really rewarding to be able to pull them together into a small group on a regular basis and just kind of help them talk through some of the things that they were looking for. And I think my experience has been that, they can get everyone in their life that has experience and has, you know, has a stake in their success that wants them to win, if you will. They're so close to it that they've got their own sort of bias and their own sort of prejudice about the person or about the situation. Mom and dad want the best for them, but they might have their own agenda. Their siblings might want the best for them, but they might have their own agenda. Their roommates or best friends might want the best for them, but they might have their own agenda at play. And it's so great to be able to come in and with no agenda and just really listen to them and really understand their thoughts and their feelings and what they're going through and just be able to help give them some things to consider or some approaches or some ways to tackle a problem or just to validate the way that they're feeling, right? Just to validate that, hey, this sucks. And everyone's telling you, don't worry about it. It's going to be okay. Like it sucks. And it's okay if you feel like it sucks right now. And so it's just been a really, really rewarding. I've only met with my new cohort once, but we're starting this journey now as we go through the rest of the year. And I just think it's a fantastic program. You talked about not really having that strong mentor in the first half of your career. What do you think makes, what do you think is special about the mentoring relationship in your experience?
Well, I think from a couple different perspectives. One is being the mentor. It's a great way to give back, and you can really see the difference you make in other people's lives. And it brings more purpose to my life in doing that. And I know, I heard it from you, and all the mentors we have in our program, they just love it because of that, right?
Yep.
And I want to thank you for being part of the program. And especially in the COVID last year or this year that we're still in, a mentoring program it's almost evident, wow, can really make a difference, right? It helps them in tough, challenging situations. So it's adding even more value, I think, right now. So that's kind of from the perspective of a mentor. From the perspective of a mentee is to first just raise your hand and say, wow, I want to be mentored. I'd need to be mentored. And I didn't have that mindset. I didn't really even know what mentoring was, but I wasn't one to raise my hand and say, I need help. I want somebody to help me. I want somebody to guide me. And I kind of felt like I got to figure out on my own. And that was not the right way to be thinking, right? And it took me a while to learn that. And mentoring, actually, if you get a mentor, it's kind of a shortcut. You can get some good direction as people asking some really good questions that then once you start to answer those questions, help you probably do more and be more in any area of your life, right? Whether it's work, education, your own personal growth or personal development, maybe issues, with family or socially or whatever. But I think if you can get mentors around you that help you in all of those areas, it can surely make life a lot better.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I thought, I've got a high school senior. And so it's also just given me this really, I'm so grateful to have this perspective in talking to these young people who are, wrapping up their college career in most cases, and kind of what they've gone through and their poise and the things that they've learned and, the way that they're thinking about the world. And without sort of the father-daughter dynamic, I want to have those conversations with my children. And I do, but I'll never get that kind of feedback because of the dynamic that we have. And so it gives me a perspective, a really interesting perspective that I can take into my own life and share it with the people that are close to me. And so I wanted to thank you for championing this cause and founding this organization. I think it's a really great group. If there are people who want to get to know you, want to connect with you either through SDS or want to talk about the Wildcat Mentor Society for their alma mater or their school, what's the best way to reach you, Andy?
Well, I'd say you can reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Okay.
They can find me. I think it's Andy Harris 4.
Okay.
Is my LinkedIn. And then my email and sure. is also andyharris4@gmail.com. So they're free to email me.
Awesome. Well, I will make sure that your contact information is included in our show notes today. You can find those. We'll put a copy of this recording with video on our website at prosalesconnection.com/podcast. And you can find all the notes and Andy's contact information there. Look, I really enjoyed visiting with you today. Thanks so much for taking the time. I know you're extremely busy. So I just wanted to thank you again. Thanks so much, Andy. So,
hey, Mike, thank you. I think what you're doing is fantastic too, and really admire and respect it. And was honored that you even reached out to me and asked me to do this. So thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. Look, before I wrap up, I just want to take a minute and thank all the people who have been following the podcast. Those that are downloading and listening to it on a regular basis, I'm really grateful for that. Thank you so much. If you want to continue to support the podcast, allow me the opportunity to continue to bring great speakers and thought leaders in business like Andy to the program, please go to iTunes, give us a 5-star review, leave a comment, share your thoughts about what you like about the program. That really does have a really positive impact on people's ability to discover this broadcast. And so thank you for doing that. If you've already done it already, thank you so much. I just want to remind everyone that when B2B leaders grow companies faster, it's because they're focusing on the big three. And so, look, everyone have a great day. We'll talk again soon. Bye.
You're listening to the Big Three of B2B Leadership Podcast with Mike Faherty, where world-class business leaders share their secrets for personal, organizational, and market growth. Gain powerful insights from industry leaders that have been tested by the fire.